This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program, and happy Thanksgiving. I hope that right now or earlier in this day, you have celebrated a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family, and it's just a great time. And it has become an American institution. The very first attested Thanksgiving celebration was on September the 8th of 1565. That's, of course, before the Pilgrims arrived. That was in St. Augustine, Florida. It was in 1621 that Americans believe the first traditional Thanksgiving was held, that at the site of Plymouth Plantation back in the year 1621. Now, my wife and I were there just on Saturday at Plymouth Plantation and in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and it was very interesting to be there on just days before the Thanksgiving celebration. It was very cold. It was very bitter. It was also very beautiful. Looking out from Plymouth, Massachusetts, you're looking at the beautiful Atlantic Ocean. You're seeing a very beautiful sight. It is moving to see the rock right there, Plymouth Rock, commemorated as the place where the pilgrims arrived in 1620. And, you know, you're looking at an amazing thing when you start looking at Plymouth Plantation and all the rest. You're looking at resilience, human resilience. You're looking at thankfulness out of the most difficult circumstances. Let me tell you what I'm talking about there. When you look at the marker, it's a big marker there at Plymouth, Massachusetts. You're also looking at one of the burial grounds where there is a marker for those who died in the first winter among the pilgrims who came over on the Mayflower. Half of those who survived the voyage died in that first winter. They arrived famished, having had an inadequate diet on the transatlantic crossing. Then they arrived just before Christmas when the weather was in Boston area. Of course, there was no Boston yet, but in Massachusetts there, Plymouth Bay was just coming to be very, very cold. And half of them died in that first winter. You start looking at the adversities they'd already experienced, and you might think that Thanksgiving would not be what was on their hearts, but it was. Now, Thanksgiving has become a little bit of a controversy in America. Two interesting stories. The Boston Globe, Sunday story. Also in Monday's edition of the paper, a very similar story. At Plymouth Plantation, they are actually stopping children and making them take off pilgrim and Indian costumes before they can come into Plymouth Plantation. It is considered to be demeaning to Native Americans because they have on what is basically a facsimile of the imagination of what someone thinks Indians once looked like. But you got little kindergartners arriving wearing their little Indian headdresses made out of construction paper and perhaps carrying their beaded purses. And then you've got others showing up with the buckled hats and others, and they're being turned away. They're being told that that is insensitive. Now, frankly, I'm never going to speak up for insensitivity. But it does seem at times that political correctness can go too far, because after all, that might be an opportunity to teach 5- and 6- and 7-year-olds something, but probably not a good opportunity to teach them by making them take off their costumes and all the rest. But in any event, I'll not argue that. The same thing is going on in California, where some school districts are now saying that children can't, have the parties for Thanksgiving where they play the parts of the Indians and the pilgrims, the settlers, because that's just not good history. Well, you know, there's a sense in which the historical argument is really important here. Here is a matter of historical admission. The historical admission is we don't have enough data on the first Thanksgiving to say exactly what did happen. There are some extant memories that were recorded and written down, but it is almost certain, just as a matter of historical honesty, that the myth about Thanksgiving, about the Indians and about the settlers sitting down to turkey and cranberry sauce, that has a lot of mythology about it. But it's also true, and it is an irrefutable fact, that there was an historic event in which Native Americans and the settlers did gather together in order for there to be a Thanksgiving. And that is never inappropriate. And so when you start thinking about demythologizing Thanksgiving, you realize we've reached some point in this culture in which what is claimed to be historical investigation takes on a very different complexion. By the way, the United States, of course, is not the only country to have a Thanksgiving celebration. Canada has Thanksgiving on the date of 25 October, and there are also Thanksgiving celebrations in some other countries. But it is not a part of British culture. And this was really interesting. I was reading an article in a British newspaper this past week in which a British observer was saying, if you don't know the difference between Americans and British people, one difference comes down to Thanksgiving. He said, not that British people are not thankful. It's just that we would never think of our national identity coming down to a day of Thanksgiving. And I find that very interesting. And I found it interesting that a British observer said about Americans that evidently this is a very patriotic holiday. And you know, there is some truth in that. It is tied to our nation's history. This Thanksgiving, which some are trying to change in terms of political correctness. And by the way, if we have good historical data that can correct the record, let's correct the record. We want to know what the truth was. But the rather cynical approach to looking at our nation's history and saying, let's cleanse ourselves of all of our national myths and traditions, that's just an impoverishment that we should not choose for ourselves. Here's the bottom line. Some people are just embarrassed about Thanksgiving. I wrote an article a couple of years ago in which I asked this question. If you do not believe in God, what do you do on Thanksgiving? To whom do you give thanks? I mean, certainly there are other human beings to whom we are indebted. But, you know, it really makes it hard to have a great festival for Thanksgiving unless you're thanking someone. And this is where I think an awful lot of Americans end up perhaps having more conscience about the reality of God's existence on Thanksgiving than perhaps at other times. It is also interesting to consider looking at the history of the Mayflower and all the rest. Very interesting work being done there, by the way. Good historians trying to take a look at all of this. It's another reminder of the fact that this nation does have a history. And we're not just an accidental nation. We are a nation that I believe is traceable to specific acts of divine providence. That doesn't mean that I believe America is unique in this. It does mean that if you believe in a sovereign God who rules over all things, if you believe that the Apostle Paul was right when he said in Acts chapter 17 that indeed God is behind even the formation of nations and ethnicities and all the rest, if you believe that, then you have to believe that America is not just an accident, that there is something distinctive about this country that is important for the unfolding of God's ways with humanity. There are a lot of lessons that have been learned in American history. There are an incredible number of misdeeds, of things that cause us embarrassment, of things that we wish had not been when we look at our nation's history. There are embarrassments like slavery. There are humiliations like a civil war. But let's also remember that this is a nation that has had a distinctive part to play in the history of the world, and even now, for great good. There are a lot of things that I am thankful for this Thanksgiving, not just in terms of the American celebration of Thanksgiving, but because I, as a Christian, I'm trying to take some inventory of the things for which I am and should be thankful. You know, there's a very interesting study that came out just a couple of years ago indicating from a psychological and psychiatric standpoint that persons who are thankful tend to be healthier than people who are not thankful. Now, you know, let's pause and think about that for just a moment. Why would people who are not thankful be unhealthy? Well, if you are not thankful, you must assume that somehow you are the very center of the universe. I don't know how you deal with that. I don't know how, as a person, you would just honestly admit you're not thankful. You have no one to whom you're indebted. There is nothing that you have that you didn't deserve. There is no reason for you to thank anyone because you have done everything for yourself. You're a self-made man, a self-made woman. You know, I'm thankful for a lot of things. I'm thankful that I've been given the gift of life. I'm thankful that I am living at this time in this place. I know there are advantages and disadvantages of living at any time, at any place, but I'll tell you, I believe it is God's purpose that I be alive at this time, that the challenges I face are today's challenges. I'm thankful that I have the opportunities the Lord has given me. I'm thankful, first and foremost, for the things that go far beyond job and vocation and career, that go far beyond possessions, for which I am thankful, for financial stability, for which so many people are rightly thankful. I'm thankful that I was born to parents who loved me and cared for me. I am thankful that I was raised by parents who raised me in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. I'm thankful that I had churches of which I was a part from the time I was young that helped to shape my understanding of God and the gospel. I am thankful that I came to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ when I was 9 years old. I'm thankful for a bivocational preacher who presented the gospel to a bunch of wiggling vacation Bible school students when I was 9 years old. I'm thankful for Boy Scouts and for all the experiences I had. I'm thankful for school teachers that taught me in school. I'm thankful for my wife. I am thankful for my children. I am thankful for the students I get to teach, for the congregation where I get to preach, I'm thankful for this radio program, and folks, that means I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful that day in and day out, there is good conversation to be had here about the things that matter. I hope you're thankful on this Thanksgiving Day. If you take inventory, you'll come to understand exactly what that study insinuated. It implied this: if you're not thankful, you're probably not seeing reality. It's not only unhealthy, it's downright irrational. So happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Every once in a while you see something and you say, that's a stroke of genius. Why hasn't someone done that before? I'm referring to the Marriage Index, which is a major research project undertaken by the Institute for American Values, in conjunction with the new National Center for African American Marriage and Parenting. It is indeed an incredibly brilliant idea, even though what it tells us is fairly devastating as a warning about the state of our society, and in particular, marriage as a part of it. My guest today to talk about this subject is Maggie Gallagher, who is president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy, graduate of Yale University. She's one of my favorite people to talk to about just about anything, but I'll tell you, when it comes to the issues of marriage, and the fight to protect marriage, the issue of same-sex marriage, few have the kind of experience and expertise as Maggie Gallagher. Maggie, welcome to the Albert Mueller Program.
Well, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, I first knew of this research project in a syndicated column that you wrote on the five leading indicators of marriage. And if I could encapsulate this, Maggie, it seems to me that what we have here is something that's tantamount to what we get from the economy or from the Defense Department or Homeland Security on a quick grid about how well we're doing or how poorly we're doing.
Yeah, I think there is a brilliance to this project, like so many things the Institute for American Values does. And the name, the five leading indicators of marriage, is a tip-off to, you know, the leading economic indicators. And as the report authors say, these aren't just kind of dry statistics. They're a serious attempt to measure the underlying health of the economy in a quick and easy way that allows us to figure out, you know, are we doing better or are we doing worse? And they are live. I mean, they inform the political discussion, the policy discussion. If the leading economic indicators are not doing well, people say, oh, we have to do things to improve the economy, get more jobs. So the product is wonderful, but the most brilliant part is asking that question. Why is it, given how fundamental marriage is, how important it is to child well-being and to the well-being of society in generally, how come nobody's even bothered to, you know, come up with a measure that tells us in a quick and easy fashion how well is marriage doing? And so that's what the leading marriage indicator does.
Maggie, I'm looking at a number. The number for 2008 is 60.3. The number for 1970 is 76.2. We're talking here about a 16% slide in the combined marriage indicators. Let's just break that down for a moment. The five that you list that are the composites of this index are a marriage rate, the divorce measure, a marital happiness measure, the proportion of babies who were born to married people, and the proportion of all children who live with their own two married parents. Tell us how this works.
Well, again, I think these are nothing is perfect. Marriage, you know, is about many different things, but I think this is an excellent choice of five different statistics that together, that each one of us tells us something a little bit different about the health of marriage, and together they give us a fairly broad and comprehensive picture. So you start with the marriage rate. That's the proportion of adults between the ages of 20 and 54 who are married. And if you were looking at, if your listeners could look at this graph, they would see another sharp sliding red downward slash. Now some of them may be wondering why 20 to 54, right? Why? Well, sometimes the marriage rate can drop because people live longer and eventually one of them dies. What we're trying to capture, what the Leading Marriage Indicator is trying to capture, is whether or not adults in their prime of life are married or not. And we've seen a very sharp decline in this particular indicator since 1970, and it is driven partly by divorce, but a lot of it has to do with the delay of marriage among people in their 20s, which has not been accompanied by a delay in sexual behavior or union formation or childbearing. So it's particularly disturbing.
You know, Maggie, tomorrow on this program, we're going to have an interesting conversation with some folks about the delay of marriage and why that's happened and what a lot of folks, especially in the church, are trying to do to reverse that trend. But I really appreciate the fact that the Institute for American Values, when it's coming up with the marriage rate, goes down to 20. By the way, in their report, they document that 59% of women under the age of 24 already self-report that they had cohabited. So obviously marriage would be a factor there if they intended to get married.
Right. So it measures the extent to which people connect, sexual intimacy and living together arrangements with marriage in part. And the cutoff at 20 might be controversial. That's partly driven by the way statistics are collected. But the research on risk of divorce is fairly clear at this point, and it really does suggest that we have exaggerated ideas about how old you have to be old enough to make a good marriage. And there doesn't really seem to be, on a mass scale, to taking individuals aside, you don't really improve your risk of making a good and lasting marriage by delaying marriage beyond your early to mid-20s.
As a matter of fact, the report cites a study that indicates that persons who marry between the ages of 22 to 25 reported the happiest marriages.
Yeah, and I think that's probably because that's now countercultural, and the people who do it tend to be, first of all, they tend to be educated because they waited till they were 22, but they also tend to be more religious and more traditional and more committed to marriage as an idea and as an institution. And that turns out to be very important. If you want to look at the graph, the measure that I found most striking, it's the decline in marital happiness. The reason that's striking is we've seen a large increase in divorce. So we were all promised that if we have an easy and open divorce culture, that the bad marriages would disappear, and the good marriages that remain ought to be much happier on average, just because we're divorcing so many. But instead, we find the exact opposite, that a very large increase in divorce was accompanied by a measurable decline in the proportion of married people who say they're very happy.
Well, just to come back to affirm what you've said here, Norville Glenn, the University of Texas, put out a study cited in the report indicating that one of the reasons why spouses said that they were unhappy in marriage is because marriage was no longer considered to be a permanent institution. Once you subvert the permanence of marriage, you actually also, it turns out, really subvert the happiness of marriage.
That's right. People marry because they want to do something other than just hanging out together until one of them leaves. And if they don't have confidence, I think one of the reasons married people are happier is that they have more of a sense that their marriages are likely to last because there's a third party, God and the church, involved in the relationship. Having said that, there's, of course, an enormous amount of divorce as well as unmarried childbearing among Christians, and we all need to do a lot better job.
Maggie, I have to ask you one quick question, especially about that second measure. We're getting ready to go into a break, but you didn't just make that up. Folks just aren't making up this marital happiness index. How is that measured? I think there are a lot of spouses out there going, how do you measure that?
Sure. Oh, you want me to answer that now, or are we going to break?
Well, we can come back to that, but I do think it's the kind of question that leads persons to wonder, okay, was this just someone's subjective experience, or how is that reported? We'll talk about it when we come back. Also, we're going to talk about these other leading indicators of marriage. The bottom line in all of this is that we are now talking about answering some questions that should have been asked a long time ago and providing data that gives us an understanding not only of the state of marriage and the health of marriage in this society, but by extension, the health of the society itself. We're going to be back to continue this conversation with Maggie Gallagher in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
host of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. My guest today is Maggie Gallagher, and when you're talking about marriage, you're talking about where she's the expert in understanding the state of marriage in the United States today, also around the world. She's very active in defending marriage, which I greatly appreciate, a key ally for all of us who are very much concerned with the preservation of marriage in this society. She's president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy. Maggie, when we were going into that last break, we were talking about the fact that this marital happiness index is also based in a very important statistical research project.
Well, you know, there's a long-running measure of family growth, the National Survey of Family and Households, and which has measured the happiness of married people over and over again. And so this is based on large nationally representative data. But you ask, like, how do social scientists measure happiness? And actually, it is a fairly simple thing. We do just ask people whether they're happy in their marriage, and usually it's on a 5 or 7 point scale. And this measure counts only as happy, only people who say they're very happy with their marriage. And we have found that people who give any kind of equivocal answer often have quite dramatic difficulties. So, I mean, the good news is the vast majority of married people still say they're happy. It's 62% in 2008. They're very happy with their marriage. But it's down from 1970, where it was 67%. And as I said, that is extremely striking, given how many more marriages end in divorce. You would think the marriages that remained would get happier. Instead, I think you're right. I think people carry a fear in the back of their heads that this marriage might not last, and that interferes with making the kinds of full-hearted investments in marriage that make people happy.
You know, Maggie, several years ago, a feminist writing actually about the abortion revolution referred to pregnancy, and she said now every pregnancy is a tentative pregnancy, and because abortion now makes it tentative, and in the same sense, divorce has made every marriage tentative by undermining the permanence of the institution. But I really wanted to point out that this issue of happiness is not just someone who's mildly happy. The persons who responded to this had to say they were very happy
That's
in their
right.
marriages.
They could have said we're kind of happy, we're sort of happy, we're happier than most. They said, no, we're very happy with our marriage.
And I think it is significant that 62% did say that they are very happy. I wish that percentage were much higher than that, but it does give us somewhere to begin working.
Now, well, and what this measure doesn't capture, mm-hmm. but the other thing we know from other research, is that married people are also personally happier, right? So you can ask people if they're
healthier.
Happy with their marriage. You can also just ask them, you know, are they very happy with their lives? And, married people are the happiest people. There's no guarantee nobody's happy all the time. But overall, we do know that people who forge stable, lasting, average, good enough marriages are much happier than people in other kinds of lives.
The other leading indicator cited in this report involve a marriage rate. We talked about that, but also a divorce rate or a divorce measure.
Right.
And we had on earlier this week Brad Wilcox, sociologist at the University of Virginia, talking about what has happened on the evolution of divorce in America. You might say unintended consequences of legislation
right.
and social change. But the reality is that we now have what he talks about as a divorce divide. You know, very clearly, you have well-educated people who are actually divorcing at lower rates than 20 years ago. But you have others that are divorcing at much higher rates.
Well, that's right. The overall divorce rate has declined very gently since its peak, and that's good news. But there is an enormous class divide buried in that. There's been a fairly dramatic reduction in the divorce risk of college-educated and a fairly uniform increase in the divorce risk of everyone else, who's the majority of people. And it does mean that marriage, which is a generator of social capital, it's a generator of wealth, understood as all of the good stuff that makes people better off, not just money, but it includes money. It's now like education; it's a social good that's increasingly available only to children who are already advantaged. So we're likely to be increasing inequality unless we can close that marriage gap. I thought the measure they chose for divorce was one of the best ones that's statistically available. I mean, in one sense, ultimately what people want to know is the future. What's the likelihood that my marriage will end in divorce? And that's a prediction. It's not a fact. So what that could change depending on how many people end up divorcing and staying married. So they took a measure of what percentage of first marriages are still intact among people aged 20 to 59. And it's 61% of people who have ever married in their first marriage are still in their first marriage.
We're going to come back to talk about what that means, by the way. That's a drop of 17.5 percentage points, and that's devastating news. We're going to come back to talk about that and two other indicators that have to do with children. This is really going to be interesting, and we'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler Program. The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. My guest today is Maggie Gallagher, the indomitable defender of marriage and an expert in social policy. I'm always glad to have on the program. She's the president of the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy. And she wrote a fascinating column about the new marriage index undertaken by the Institute for American Values, where she was once a key staff member as well. Maggie, when we went into the break, we were talking about the divorce rate. I want to skip ahead to talk about the two indices that have to do with children. The first related to how many are born to married couples, and then how many children are still living with their parents who are married to each other. Why is that so important as an indicator of marriage?
Well, that's a good question, and the answer really is that the first three measures are a measure of the health of the relationship between the two adults. The last two measures are a measure of the connection or relationship between marriage and child well-being. Is marriage serving its prime public purpose of creating the next generation and connecting those children to a mother and father? How well are we doing on that? And the single most disturbing indicator is the percentage of births to married parents. As recently as 1970, when I was 10, that was 90% of babies were born to married parents. In 2008, it's just 60%. 40% of our babies begin life with an unmarried mother at this point, and that's just devastating.
And we've talked about the divorce divide. There also is, in this case, a divide on the out-of-wedlock births. But, Maggie, I'm looking at research that indicates that, that for instance, educated suburbanites are catching up with other groups in society in terms of babies born outside of wedlock.
Well, college-educated women are still dramatically less likely than other women. But high school educated women, you know, women it's not just, let's put it this way, it's not just poor black women in those devastated inner cities. It's becoming a fairly broad trend. As you can imagine, if it's 40% of all your babies, that's an extremely common experience. And the other thing I think most people don't realize, it's not in this graph, but if 40% of all babies are born out of wedlock, that means probably more than half of all first babies are born to an unwed mother, because just the relationship between the total number of babies and the babies that are born first. So I don't have the hard data here, but I do know the relationship in the past between those two figures, and it really strongly suggests that something close or even more than a majority of American women become mothers for the first time out of wedlock.
Saw a report this week from Great Britain in which it said that high school girls, when asked to answer the question in Great Britain, which comes first, marriage or motherhood, the majority said motherhood.
Yeah, no, we have research like that. I don't know if it's a majority, but that's kind of life script research,
right,
where you ask girls just separately, what's the right age to have children, what's the right age to get married? And we're delaying marriage, but in Europe they're delaying marriage to an even greater extent. Sometimes in some countries the average age of first marriage is close to 30. So people don't really think that's the ideal age to be a mother. but they do think it's the ideal age to get married, and that demonstrates that they really have disconnected these things in their mind, in the minds of the next generation. You can lose a marriage culture, right? Your society won't function very well without it. Your civilization may die out as a result, but there is a powerful natural basis to this marriage idea. But it takes a lot of discipline and support and idealism to make it a lived reality.
Now, we have to jump to that last indicator, the percentage of children living with their own married parents. David Popino of the Institute for American Values, writing the report, says, and I quote, "Few propositions have more empirical support in the social sciences than this one. Compared to all other family forms, families headed by married biological parents are best for children," end quote.
Yeah, that's that. You know, it took a lot of social science and a lot of arguing to come to what everyone's grandmother understood deep in her soul, and it's kind of intuitively obvious. You know, there's something special about the two people who make the baby sticking around and loving each other and the baby too. And, you know, when you move to adoption, the ideal, that child lost a mother and father somewhere. The ideal for that child is also a mother and father, if it's possible to get that for a baby who needs, you know, at least a parent. This graph is interesting. First of all, in 1970, it was almost 69% of children were living with their own married parents, and it just dropped down to 60% in the year 2000. This is just a little inkling of not incredibly good news, but the good news is it's not really getting worse anymore. It was 60.5% in 2000. It's now 61%, which is basically flat or a tiny little uptick. And that, I think, it's hard to put together the increase in unwed births with a stabilizing of children living with their own married parents, unless you realize that every divorce affects far more children, typically. You know, that every birth to an unmarried parent is only one baby, yeah, unless it's twins. But a divorce will typically affect more than one child. So the fact that the divorce rate is stabilizing is helping to protect children. And I think we should draw from that, not that we don't have a big problem on our hands, but that it is possible for this problem to get a little bit better, to make improvements, and that's important.
Well, and I think one of the ways I see every week it get better on that score, even if it's incrementally, is that I get to talk to young people who say, the one thing I know is that my parents divorced and we will not.
Children of divorce didn't grow up to say, wow, it's really great that we can all get divorced. I'm really happy that happened. They talk the way the young people you know. But here's the thing. Unless churches and families and society reaches out to these children of divorce who want stable, lasting marriages, the statistics show they are more likely to divorce than children from intact families. So the desire is there, but they need these kids in particular need the support of our congregations and our
Absolutely.
Communities and our families, extended family, to help hold them to and help them live out their own ideal. Nobody gets married because they hope it ends in divorce, right?
No, so. Absolutely. Maggie, we're about to run out of time, but the number, the index right now is at 60.3. Do you have a figure beneath which a society cannot go and survive? Do you have that number in mind?
Well, we just created these leading marriage indicators, so now we'll have to go and find out. We'll have to track that, sadly. I think we're in a lot of trouble, Dr. Mohler, and I think I'm hopeful that Americans will be the one advanced society that will find a better answer.
I hope so. And you're a champion in that, Maggie. Thanks for joining us today. Maggie Gallagher is the president for the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy. And listening to her talk now, you know why. We'll be right back with final thoughts.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. That conversation with Maggie Gallagher was nothing less than fascinating, if indeed troubling. What we're looking at here is the collapse of marriage as an institution. And when I asked Maggie for that magic number beneath which a society could not go, she said, we don't have the data on that yet. You know what that means? That means we'll find it when we hit it. It reminds me of those old World War II movies in which the submarines are sinking and they say, where's the bottom? Where's the bottom? How low are we? How much more clearance do we have? And the captain says, we'll know it when we hit it. Well, that's exactly what we have to worry about here. We'll know it when we hit it. Let's hope and pray that we do not hit it. It's our job to look to this kind of a warning and say, we've got a job to do. And, you know, I really appreciated what Maggie had to say, because there are an awful lot of sociologists who, being a spokesperson for these issues, would say, This is something we primarily need to address through legislation and think tanks and symposium and all the rest. And all of those are important, but you'll notice she said this is an important issue for the church, which is, by looking at it from the other side, an indictment of the church for a failure on our part to do what we already should have been doing in defense of marriage. You know, when you rebuild a marriage culture, let me just tell you, I don't know how you do it in a secular culture. I do know that it's the Christian responsibility and the responsibility of the Christian church to rebuild that culture from within, because in a sense, the secular world has a good deal more excuse to have forgotten what marriage is and why it's important, but the Christian church has no excuse whatsoever. We have right before us the Word of God that tells us that marriage is not merely a good idea or a social convenience or a legal abstraction. Rather, it is the gift of God, the unique arena of human relatedness in which we mirror the relationship between Christ and the church, and we live out the glory of God in mutual covenant faithfulness. That's just something that we had better keep in mind as a major agenda of the church. Marriage is not just something the church does when it hosts a wedding. Marriage is the church's concern, because if we are going to be faithful to God in the name of Christ, and if we are going to bear testimony to the goodness of the Creator, we're going to talk about the goodness of His gift. One final thought. If you look at this report, remember it was co-sponsored by the Institute for American Values and the National Center on African American Marriages and Parenting. You come to understand we have a huge, huge challenge. And this is a down payment on that conversation. I'm looking forward to having someone on very shortly who can speak to us about the unique statistics coming from the look at African American marriages and parenting. A lot to learn there, a lot to be concerned about, but also a lot of ground that can be recovered, not only for the good of individuals and the gain of couples, but for the glory of God. I appreciate so much Maggie Gallagher spending that time with us. I appreciate you listening. I'll be writing about this on my website at albertmuller.com, providing you links where you can go and find the report and other data. You'll want to be showing this to others. You'll want to be tracking this this marriage index, because if you've been listening to this conversation, you now know it really matters. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.